Section 6 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Captured Saragossa. Continued. The cathedral was brilliantly lit within, and a number of people were passing in and out, so I entered, thinking that I was less likely to be accosted there, and that I might have quiet to form my plans. It was certainly a singular sight, for the place had been turned into a hospital, a refuge, and a storehouse. One aisle was crammed with provisions, another was littered with sick and wounded, while in the centre a great number of helpless people had taken up their abode, and had even lit their cooking fires upon the mosaic floors. There were many at prayer, so I knelt in the shadow of a pillar, and I prayed with all my heart that I might have the good luck to get out of this scrape alive, and that I might do such a deed that night as would make my name as famous in Spain as it had already become in Germany. I waited until the clock struck three, and then I left the cathedral and made my way towards the convent of the Madonna, where the assault was to be delivered. You will understand, you who know me so well, that I was not the man to return tamely to the French camp, with the report that our agent was dead, and that other means must be found of entering the city. Either I should find some means to finish his uncompleted task, or there would be a vacancy for a senior captain in the Hussars of Conflans. I passed unquestioned down the broad boulevard, which I have already described, until I came to the great stone convent which formed the outwork of the defence. It was built in a square with a garden in the centre. In this garden some hundreds of men were assembled, all armed and ready, for it was known, of course, within the town that this was the point against which the French attack was likely to be made. Up to this time our fighting all over Europe had always been done between one army and another. It was only here in Spain that we learned how terrible a thing it is to fight against a people. On the one hand there is no glory, for what glory could be gained by defeating this rabble of elderly shopkeepers, ignorant peasants, fanatical priests, excited women, and all the other creatures who made up the garrison? On the other hand there were extreme discomfort and danger, for these people would give you no rest, would observe no rules of war, and were desperately earnest in their desire, by hook or by crook, to do you an injury. I began to realize how odious was our task, as I looked upon the motley but ferocious groups who were gathered round the watch-fires in the garden of the convent of the Madonna. It was not for us soldiers to think about politics, but from the beginning there always seemed to be a curse upon this war in Spain. However, at the moment I had no time to brood over such matters as these. There was, as I have said, no difficulty in getting as far as the convent garden, but to pass inside the convent unquestioned was not so easy. The first thing which I did was to walk round the garden, and I was soon able to pick out one large stained-glass window which must belong to the chapel. I had understood from Hubert that the Mother Superior's room, in which the powder was stored, was near to this, and that the train had been laid through a hole in the wall from some neighbouring cell. I must at all costs get into the convent. There was a guard at the door, and how could I get in without explanations? But a sudden inspiration showed me how the thing might be done. In the garden was a well, and beside the well were a number of empty buckets. I filled two of these and approached the door. The errand of a man who carries a bucket of water in each hand does not need to be explained. The guard opened to let me through. I found myself in a long stone-flagged corridor, lit with lanterns, with the cells of the nuns leading out from one side of it. Now at last I was on the high road to success. I walked on without hesitation, for I knew by my observations in the garden which way to go for the chapel. A number of Spanish soldiers were lounging and smoking in the corridor, several of whom addressed me as I passed. I fancy it was for my blessing that they asked, and my ora pro nobis seemed to entirely satisfy them. Soon I had got as far as the chapel, and it was easy enough to see that the cell next door was used as a magazine, for the floor was all black, with powder in front of it. The door was shut, and two fierce-looking fellows stood on guard outside of it, one of them with a key stuck in his belt. Had we been alone, it would not have been long before it would have been in my hand, but with his comrade there it was impossible for me to hope to take it by force. The cell next door to the magazine, on the far side from the chapel, must be the one which belonged to Sister Angela. It was half open. I took my courage in both hands, and leaving my buckets in the corridor, I walked unchallenged into the room. I was prepared to find half a dozen fierce Spanish desperadoes within, but what actually met my eyes was even more embarrassing. The room had apparently been set aside for the use of some of the nuns, who for some reason had refused to quit their home. Three of them were within. One an elderly, stern-faced dame, who was evidently the Mother Superior. The others, young ladies of charming appearance. They were seated together at the far side of the room, but they all rose at my entrance, and I saw, with some amazement by their manner and expressions, that my coming was both welcome and expected. In a moment my presence of mind had returned, and I saw exactly how the matter lay. Naturally, since an attack was about to be made upon the convent, these sisters had been expecting to be directed to some place of safety. Probably they were under vow not to quit the walls, and they had been told to remain in this cell until they received further orders. In any case, I adapted my conduct to this supposition, since it was clear that I must get them out of the room, and this would give me a ready excuse to do so. I first cast a glance at the door, and observed that the key was within. I then made a gesture to the nuns to follow me. The Mother Superior asked me some question, but I shook my head impatiently and beckoned to her again. She hesitated, but I stamped my foot and called them forth in so imperious a manner that they came at once. They would be safer in the chapel, and thither I led them, placing them at the end which was farthest from the magazine. As the three nuns took their places before the altar, my heart bounded with joy and pride within me, for I felt that the last obstacle had been lifted from my path. And yet, how often have I not found that that is the very moment of danger? I took a last glance at the Mother Superior, and to my dismay I saw that her piercing dark eyes were fixed, with an expression in which surprise was deepening into suspicion, upon my right hand. There were two points which might well have attracted her attention. One was that it was red with the blood of the sentinel whom I had stabbed in the tree. That alone might count for little, as the knife was as familiar as the breviary to the monks of Saragossa. But on my forefinger I wore a heavy gold ring, the gift of a certain German baroness, whose name I may not mention. It shone brightly in the light of the altar lamp. Now, a ring upon a friar's hand is an impossibility, since they are vowed to absolute poverty. I turned quickly and made for the door of the chapel, but the mischief was done. As I glanced back, I saw that the Mother Superior was already hurrying after me. I ran through the chapel door and along the corridor, but she called out some shrill warning to the two guards in front. Fortunately, I had the presence of mind to call out also, and to point down the passage, as if we were both pursuing the same object. Next instant I had dashed past them, sprang into the cell, slammed the heavy door and fastened it upon the inside. With a bolt above and below and a huge lock in the centre, it was a piece of timber that would take some forcing. Even now, if they had had the wit to put a barrel of powder against the door, I should have been ruined. It was their only chance, for I had come to the final stage of my adventure. Here at last, after such a string of dangers as few men have ever lived to talk of, I was at one end of the powder train, with the Saragossa magazine at the other. They were howling like wolves out in the passage, and muskets were crashing against the door. I paid no heed to their clamour, but I looked eagerly around for that train of which Hubert had spoken. Of course, it must be at the side of the room next to the magazine. I crawled along it on my hands and knees, looking into every crevice, but no sign could I see. Two bullets flew through the door and flattened themselves against the wall. The thudding and smashing grew ever louder. I saw a grey pile in a corner, flew to it with a cry of joy, and found that it was only dust. Then I got back to the side of the door where no bullets could ever reach me. They were streaming freely into the room, and I tried to forget this fiendish howling in my ear and to think out where this train could be. It must have been carefully laid by Hubert, lest these nuns should see it. I tried to imagine how I should myself have arranged it, had I been in his place. My eye was attracted by a statue of St. Joseph, which stood in the corner. There was a wreath of leaves along the edge of the pedestal, with a lamp burning amidst them. I rushed across to it and tore the leaves aside. Yes, yes, there was a thin black line, which disappeared through a small hole in the wall. I tilted over the lamp and threw myself on the ground. Next instant came a roar like thunder. The walls wavered and tottered around me. The ceiling clattered down from above, and over the yell of the terrified Spaniards was heard the terrific shout of the storming column of grenadiers. As in a dream, a happy dream, I heard it, and then I heard no more. When I came to my senses, two French soldiers were propping me up, and my head was singing like a kettle. I staggered to my feet and looked around me. The plaster had fallen, the furniture was scattered, and there were rents in the bricks, but no sign of a breach. In fact, the walls of the convent had been so solid that the explosion of the magazine had been insufficient to throw them down. On the other hand, it had caused such a panic among the defenders that our stormers had been able to carry the windows and throw open the doors almost without assistance. As I ran out into the corridor, I found it full of troops, and I met Marshal Lannes himself, who was entering with his staff. He stopped and listened eagerly to my story. "Splendid, Captain Gerard, splendid!" he cried. "These facts will certainly be reported to the Emperor." "I would suggest to your Excellency," said I, "that I have only finished the work that was planned and carried out by Monsieur Hubert, who gave his life for the cause."
"His services will not be forgotten," said the Marshal. "Meanwhile, Captain Gerard, it is 4:30, and you must be starving after such a night of exertion. My staff and I will breakfast inside the city. I assure you that you will be an honoured guest."
"I will follow your Excellency," said I. "There is a small engagement which detains me." He opened his eyes.
"At this hour?"
"Yes, sir," I answered. "My fellow officers, whom I never saw until last night, will not be content unless they catch another glimpse of me the first thing this morning."
"Au revoir, then," said Marshal Lannes as he passed upon his way. I hurried through the shattered door of the convent. When I reached the roofless house in which we had held the consultation the night before, I threw off my gown, and I put on the busby and sabre which I had left there. Then, a hussar once more, I hurried onward to the grove which was our rendezvous. My brain was still reeling from the concussion of the powder, and I was exhausted by the many emotions which had shaken me during that terrible night. It is like a dream, all that walk in the first dim grey light of dawn, with the smouldering campfires around me, and the buzz of the waking army. Bugles and drums in every direction were mustering the infantry, for the explosion and the shouting had told their own tale. I strode onward until, as I entered the little clump of cork oaks behind the horse lines, I saw my 12 comrades waiting in a group, their sabres at their sides. They looked at me curiously as I approached. Perhaps with my powder-blackened face and my blood-stained hands, I seemed a different Gerard to the young captain whom they had made game of the night before. "Good morning, gentlemen," said I. "I regret exceedingly if I have kept you waiting, but I have not been master of my own time." They said nothing, but they still scanned me with curious eyes. I can see them now, standing in a line before me, tall men and short men, stout men and thin men, Olivier with his warlike moustache, the thin, eager face of Pelletin, young Houdin, flushed by his first duel, Mortier, with the sword cut across his wrinkled brow. I laid aside my busby and drew my sword. "I have one favour to ask you, gentlemen," said I. "Marshal Lannes has invited me to breakfast, and I cannot keep him waiting."
"What do you suggest?" asked Major Olivier.
"That you release me from my promise to give you 5 minutes each, and that you will permit me to attack you all together." I stood upon my guard as I spoke. But their answer was truly beautiful and truly French. With one impulse, the 12 swords flew from their scabbards and were raised in salute. There they stood, the 12 of them, motionless, their heels together, each with his sword upright before his face. I staggered back from them. I looked from one to the other. For an instant I could not believe my own eyes. They were paying me homage. These, the men who had jeered me. Then I understood it all. I saw the effect that I had made upon them and their desire to make reparation. When a man is weak, he can steel himself against danger, but not against emotion. Comrades, I cried, comrades, but I could say no more. Something seemed to take me by the throat and choke me, and then in an instant Olivier's arms were round me. Pelletan had seized me by the right hand, Mortier by the left. Some were patting me on the shoulder, some were clapping me on the back. On every side smiling faces were looking into mine. And so it was that I knew that I had won my footing in the Hussars of Conflans. End of section 6. An end of How the Brigadier Captured Saragossa. Section 7 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Slew the Fox. In all the great hosts of France, there was only one officer toward whom the English of Wellington's army retained a deep, steady, and unchangeable hatred. There were plunderers among the French and men of violence, gamblers, duelists, and roues. All these could be forgiven, for others of their kidney were to be found among the ranks of the English. But one officer of Massena's force had committed a crime which was unspeakable, unheard of, abominable, only to be alluded to with curses late in the evening when a second bottle had loosened the tongues of men. The news of it was carried back to England, and country gentlemen, who knew little of the details of the war, grew crimson with passion when they heard of it, and yeomen of the shires raised freckled fists to heaven and swore. And yet who should be the doer of this dreadful deed but our friend the Brigadier, Etienne Gerard of the Hussars of Conflans, gay-riding, plume-tossing debonair, the darling of the ladies and of the 6 brigades of light cavalry. But the strange part of it is that this gallant gentleman did this hateful thing and made himself the most unpopular man in the peninsula without ever knowing that he had done a crime for which there is hardly a name amid all the resources of our language. He died of old age, and never once in that imperturbable self-confidence which adorned or disfigured his character, knew that so many thousand Englishmen would gladly have hanged him with their own hands. On the contrary, he numbered this adventure among those other exploits which he has given to the world, and many a time he chuckled and hugged himself as he narrated it to the eager circle who gathered round him in that humble café where, between his dinner and his dominoes, he would tell, amid tears and laughter, of that inconceivable Napoleonic past when France, like an angel of wrath, rose up, splendid and terrible, before a cowering continent. Let us listen to him as he tells the story in his own way and from his own point of view. "You must know, my friends," said he, "that it was toward the end of the year 1810 that I and Massena and the others pushed Wellington backward until we had hoped to drive him and his army into the Tagus. But when we were still 25 miles from Lisbon, we found that we were betrayed, for what had this Englishman done but build an enormous line of works and forts at a place called Torre Vedras, so that even we were unable to get through them. They lay across the whole peninsula, and our army was so far from home that we did not dare to risk a reverse, and we had already learned at Busaco that it was no child's play to fight against these people. What could we do then but sit down in front of these lines and blockade them to the best of our power? There we remained for 6 months, amid such anxieties that Massena said afterward that he had not one hair which was not white upon his body. For my own part, I did not worry much about our situation, but I looked after our horses, who were in much need of rest and green fodder. For the rest, we drank the wine of the country and passed the time as best we might. There was a lady at Saint-Aurem, but my lips are sealed. It is the part of a gallant man to say nothing, though he may indicate that he could say a great deal. One day Massena sent for me, and I found him in his tent with a great plan pinned upon the table. He looked at me in silence, with that single piercing eye of his, and I felt by his expression that the matter was serious. He was nervous and ill at ease, but my bearing seemed to reassure him. It is good to be in contact with brave men. "Colonel Etienne Gerard," said he, "I have always heard that you are a very gallant and enterprising officer." It was not for me to confirm such a report, and yet it would be folly to deny it, so I clinked my spurs together and saluted. "You are also an excellent rider." I admitted it. "And the best swordsman in the 6 brigades of light cavalry?" Massena was famous for the accuracy of his information. "Now," said he, "if you will look at this plan, you will have no difficulty in understanding what it is that I wish you to do. These are the lines of Torres Vedras. You will perceive that they cover a vast space, and you will realize that the English can only hold a position here and there. Once through the lines, you have 25 miles of open country which lie between them and Lisbon. It is very important to me to learn how Wellington's troops are distributed throughout that space, and it is my wish that you should go and ascertain." His words turned me cold. "Sir," said I, "it is impossible that a colonel of light cavalry should condescend to act as a spy." He laughed and clapped me on the shoulder. "You would not be a hussar if you were not a hothead," said he. "If you will listen, you will understand that I have not asked you to act as a spy. What do you think of that horse?" He had conducted me to the opening of his tent, and there was a chasseur who led up and down a most admirable creature. He was a dapple grey, not very tall, a little over 15 hands perhaps, but with a short head and splendid arch of the neck which comes with the Arab blood. His shoulders and haunches were so muscular, and yet his legs so fine, that it thrilled me with joy just to gaze upon him. A fine horse or a beautiful woman, I cannot look at them unmoved. Even now, when 70 winters have chilled my blood, you can think how it was in the year 10. "This," said Massena, "is Voltigeur, the swiftest horse in our army. What I desire is that you should start tonight, ride round the lines upon the flank, make your way across the enemy's rear, and return upon the other flank, bringing me news of his disposition. You will wear a uniform, and will, therefore, if captured, be safe from the death of a spy. It is probable that you will get through the lines unchallenged, for the posts are very scattered. Once through, in daylight, you can outride anything which you meet, and if you keep off the road, you may escape entirely unnoticed. If you have not reported yourself by tomorrow night, I will understand that you are taken, and I will offer them Colonel Petrie in exchange." Ah, how my heart swelled with pride and joy as I sprang into the saddle and galloped this grand horse up and down to show the marshal the mastery which I had of him. He was magnificent. We were both magnificent, for Massena clapped his hands and cried out in his delight. It was not I, but he, who said that a gallant beast deserves a gallant rider. Then, when for the third time, with my panache flying and my dolman streaming behind me, I thundered past him, I saw upon his hard old face that he had no longer any doubt that he had chosen the man for his purpose. I drew my sabre, raised the hilt to my lips in salute, and galloped on to my own quarters. Already the news had spread that I had been chosen for a mission, and my little rascals came swarming out of their tents to cheer me. Ah, it brings the tears to my old eyes when I think how proud they were of their colonel. And I was proud of them also. They deserved a dashing leader. The night promised to be a stormy one, which was very much to my liking. It was my desire to keep my departure most secret, for it was evident that if the English heard that I had been detached from the army, they would naturally conclude that something important was about to happen. My horse was taken, therefore, beyond the picket line, as if for watering, and I followed and mounted him there. I had a map, a compass, and a paper of instructions from the marshal, and with these in the bosom of my tunic and my sabre at my side, I set out upon my adventure. A thin rain was falling, and there was no moon, so you may imagine that it was not very cheerful. But my heart was light at the thought of the honour which had been done me, and the glory which awaited me. This exploit should be one more in that brilliant series which was to change my sabre into a baton. Ah, how we dreamed, we foolish fellows, young and drunk with success! Could I have foreseen that night as I rode, the chosen man of 60,000, that I should spend my life planting cabbages on 100 francs a month? Oh, my youth, my hopes, my comrades! But the wheel turns and never stops. Forgive me, my friends, for an old man has his weakness. My route, then, lay across the face of the high ground of Torrevedras, then over a streamlet, past a farmhouse which had been burned down and was now only a landmark, then through a forest of young cork oaks, and so to the monastery of San Antonio, which marked the left of the English position. Here I turned south and rode quietly over the downs, for it was at this point that Massena thought that it would be most easy for me to find my way unobserved through the position. I went very slowly, for it was so dark that I could not see my hand in front of me. In such cases I leave my bridle loose and let my horse pick its own way. Voltigeur went confidently forward, and I was very content to sit upon his back and to peer about me, avoiding every light. For 3 hours we advanced in this cautious way, until it seemed to me that I must have left all danger behind me. I then pushed on more briskly, for I wished to be in the rear of the whole army by daybreak. There are many vineyards in these parts, which in winter become open plains, and a horseman finds few difficulties in his way. But Massena had underrated the cunning of these English, for it appears that there was not one line of defence, but three, and it was the third which was the most formidable, through which I was at that instant passing. As I rode, elated at my own success, a lantern flashed suddenly before me, and I saw the glint of polished gun-barrels and the gleam of a red coat. "Who goes there?" cried a voice. Such a voice! I swerved to the right and rode like a madman, but a dozen squirts of fire came out of the darkness, and the bullets whizzed all round my ears. That was no new sound to me, my friends, though I will not talk like a foolish conscript and say that I have ever liked it. But at least it had never kept me from thinking clearly, and so I knew that there was nothing for it but to gallop hard and try my luck elsewhere. I rode round the English picket, and then, as I heard nothing more of them, I concluded rightly that I had at last come through their defences. For 5 miles I rode south, striking a tinder from time to time to look at my pocket compass, and then, in an instant, I feel the pang once more as my memory brings back the moment. My horse, without a sob or staggers, fell stone dead beneath me. I had never known it, but one of the bullets from that infernal picket had passed through his body. The gallant creature had never winced nor weakened, but had gone while life was in him. One instant I was secure on the swiftest, most graceful horse in Massena's army. The next he lay upon his side, worth only the price of his hide, and I stood there, that most helpless, most ungainly of creatures, a dismounted hussar. What could I do with my boots, my spurs, my trailing sabre? I was far inside the enemy's lines. How could I hope to get back again? I am not ashamed to say that I, Etienne Gerard, sat upon my dead horse and sank my face in my hands in my despair. Already the first streaks were whitening in the east. In half an hour it would be light. That I should have won my way past every obstacle, and then at this last instant be left at the mercy of my enemies, my mission ruined, and myself a prisoner, was it not enough to break a soldier's heart? But courage, my friends! We have these moments of weakness, the bravest of us, but I have a spirit like a slip of steel, for the more you bend it, the higher it springs. One spasm of despair, and then a brain of ice and a heart of fire. All was not yet lost. I, who had come through so many hazards, would come through this one also. I rose from my horse and considered what had best be done. And first of all, it was certain that I could not get back. Long before I could pass the lines, it would be broad daylight. I must hide myself for the day, and then devote the next night to my escape. I took the saddle, holsters, and bridle from poor Voltigeur, and I concealed them among some bushes, so that no one finding him could know that he was a French horse. Then, leaving him lying there, I wandered on in search of some place where I might be safe for the day. In every direction I could see campfires upon the sides of the hills, and already figures had begun to move around them. I must hide quickly or I was lost. But where was I to hide? It was a vineyard in which I found myself, the poles of the vines still standing, but the plants gone. There was no cover there. Besides, I should want some food and water before another night had come. I hurried wildly onward through the waning darkness, trusting that chance would be my friend. And I was not disappointed. Chance is a woman, my friends, and she has her eye always upon a gallant hussar. Well, then, as I stumbled through the vineyard, something loomed in front of me, and I came upon a great square house, with another long, low building upon one side of it. Three roads met there, and it was easy to see that this was the posada, or wine shop. There was no light in the windows, and everything was dark and silent, but, of course, I knew that such comfortable quarters were certainly occupied, and probably by someone of importance. I have learned, however, that the nearer the danger may really be the safer place, and so I was by no means inclined to trust myself away from this shelter. The low building was evidently the stable, and into this I crept, for the door was unlatched. The place was full of bullocks and sheep, gathered there, no doubt, to be out of the clutches of marauders. A ladder led to a loft, and up this I climbed and concealed myself very snugly among some bales of hay upon the top. This loft had a small open window, and I was able to look down upon the front of the inn and also upon the road. There I crouched and waited to see what would happen. End of section 7. Section 8 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Slew the Fox. Continued. It was soon evident that I had not been mistaken when I had thought that this might be the quarters of some person of importance. Shortly after daybreak, an English light dragoon arrived with a dispatch, and from then onward the place was in a turmoil, officers continually riding up and away. Always the same name was upon their lips, Sir Stapleton, Sir Stapleton. It was hard for me to lie there with a dry moustache and watch the great flagons which were brought out by the landlord to these English officers. But it amused me to look at their fresh-coloured, clean-shaven, careless faces, and to wonder what they would think if they knew that so celebrated a person was lying so near to them. And then, as I lay and watched, I saw a sight which filled me with surprise. It is incredible, the insolence of these English. What do you suppose Milord Wellington had done when he found that Massena had blockaded him, and that he could not move his army? I might give you many guesses. You might say that he had raged, that he had despaired, that he had brought his troops together and spoken to them about glory and the fatherland, before leading them to one last battle? No, Milord did none of these things, but he sent a fleet ship to England to bring him a number of fox-dogs, and he, with his officers, settled himself down to chase the fox. It is true what I tell you. Behind the lines of Torre Vedras, these mad Englishmen made the fox-chase 3 days in the week. We had heard of it in the camp, and now I was myself to see that it was true. For along the road which I have described, there came these very dogs, 30 or 40 of them, white and brown, each with its tail at the same angle, like the bayonets of the old guard. My faith, but it was a pretty sight! And behind and amidst them there rode three men with peaked caps and red coats, whom I understood to be the hunters. After them came many horsemen with uniforms of various kinds, stringing along the road in twos and threes, talking together and laughing. They did not seem to be going above a trot, and it appeared to me that it must indeed be a slow fox which they hoped to catch. However, it was their affair, not mine, and soon they had all passed my window and were out of sight. I waited and I watched, ready for any chance which might offer. Presently an officer, in a blue uniform, not unlike that of our flying artillery, came cantering down the road. An elderly stout man he was, with grey side whiskers. He stopped and began to talk with an orderly officer of dragoons who waited outside the inn, and it was then that I learned the advantage of the English which had been taught me. I could hear and understand all that was said. "Where is the meat?" said the officer, and I thought that he was hungering for his beefsteak. But the other answered him that it was near Altara, so I saw that it was a place of which he spoke. "You are late, Sir George," said the orderly. "Yes, I had a court-martial. Has Sir Stapleton Cotton gone?" At this moment a window opened, and a handsome young man in a very splendid uniform looked out of it. "Halloa, Murray," said he. "These cursed papers keep me, but I'll be at your heels." "Very good, Cotton. I am late already, so I will ride on." "You might order my groom to bring round my horse," said the young general at the window to the orderly below, while the other went on down the road. The orderly rode away to some outlying stable, and then in a few minutes there came a smart English groom with a cockade in his hat, leading by the bridle a horse. And oh, my friends, you have never known the perfection to which a horse can attain until you have seen a first-class English hunter. He was superb, tall, broad, strong, and yet as graceful and agile as a deer. Coal-black he was in colour, and his neck and his shoulders and his quarters and his fetlocks. How can I describe him all to you? The sun shone upon him as on a polished ebony, and he raised his hooves in a little playful dance, so lightly and prettily, while he tossed his mane and whinnied with impatience. Never have I seen such a mixture of strength and beauty and grace. I had often wondered how the English hussars had managed to ride over the chasseurs of the guards in the affair at Astorga, but I wondered no longer when I saw the English horses. There was a ring for fastening bridles at the door of the inn, and the groom tied the horse there while he entered the house. In an instant I had seen the chance which fate had brought to me. Were I in that saddle, I should be better off than when I started. Even Voltigeur could not compare with this magnificent creature. To think is to act with me. In one instant I was down the ladder and at the door of the stable. The next I was out, and the bridle was in my hand. I bounded into the saddle. Somebody, the master or the man, shouted wildly behind me. What cared I for his shouts? I touched the horse with my spurs, and he bounded forward with such a spring that only a rider like myself could have sat him. I gave him his head and let him go. It did not matter to me where, so long as we left this inn far behind us. He thundered away across the vineyards, and in a very few minutes I had placed miles between myself and my pursuers. They could no longer tell, in that wild country, in which direction I had gone. I knew that I was safe, and so, riding to the top of a small hill, I drew my pencil and notebook from my pocket, and proceeded to make plans of those camps which I could see, and to draw the outline of the country. He was a dear creature upon whom I sat, but it was not easy to draw upon his back, for every now and then his two ears would cock, and he would start and quiver with impatience. At first I could not understand this trick of his, but soon I observed that he only did it when a peculiar noise, "Yoy, yoy, yoy," came from somewhere among the oak woods beneath us. And then, suddenly, this strange cry changed into a most terrible screaming, with a frantic blowing of a horn. Instantly he went mad, this horse. His eyes blazed, his mane bristled. He bounded from the earth and bounded again, twisting and turning in a frenzy. My pencil flew one way and my notebook another. And then, as I looked down into the valley, an extraordinary sight met my eyes. The hunt was streaming down it. The fox I could not see, but the dogs were in full cry, their noses down, their tails up, so close together that they might have been one great yellow and white moving carpet. And behind them rode the horsemen. My faith, what a sight! Consider every type which a great army could show. Some in hunting dress, but the most in uniforms. Blue dragoons, red-trousered hussars, green riflemen, artillerymen, gold-slashed lancers, and most of all, red, for the infantry officers ride as hard as the cavalry. Such a crowd, some well-mounted, some ill, but all flying along as best they might, the subaltern as good as the general, jostling and pushing, spurring and driving, with every thought thrown to the winds, save that they should have the blood of this absurd fox. Truly, they are an extraordinary people, the English. But I had little time to watch the hunt or to marvel at these islanders, for of all these mad creatures, the very horse upon which I sat was the maddest. You understand that he was himself a hunter, and that the crying of these dogs was to him what the call of a cavalry trumpet in the street yonder would be to me. It thrilled him, it drove him wild. Again and again he bounded into the air, and then, seizing the bit between his teeth, he plunged down the slope and galloped after the dogs. I swore and tugged and pulled, but I was powerless. This English general rode his horse with a snaffle only, and the beast had a mouth of iron. It was useless to pull him back. One might as well try to keep a grenadier from a wine bottle. I gave it up in despair, and, settling down in the saddle, I prepared for the worst which could befall. What a creature he was! Never have I felt such a horse between my knees. His great haunches gathered under him with every stride, and he shot forward ever faster and faster, stretched like a greyhound, while the wind beat in my face and whistled past my ears. I was wearing our undress jacket, a uniform simple and dark in itself, though some figures give distinction to any uniform, and I had taken the precaution to remove the long panache from my busby. The result was that, amidst the mixture of costumes in the hunt, there was no reason why mine should attract attention, or why these men, whose thoughts were all with the chase, should give any heed to me. The idea that a French officer might be riding with them was too absurd to enter their minds. I laughed as I rode, for indeed, amid all the danger, there was something of comic in the situation. I have said that the hunters were very unequally mounted, and so, at the end of a few miles, instead of being one body of men, like a charging regiment, they were scattered over a considerable space, the better riders well up to the dogs, and the others trailing away behind. Now, I was as good a rider as any, and my horse was the best of them all, and so you can imagine that it was not long before he carried me to the front. And when I saw the dogs streaming over the open, and the red-coated huntsman behind them, and only 7 or 8 horsemen between us, then it was that the strangest thing of all happened, for I too went mad. I, Etienne Gerard! In a moment it came upon me, this spirit of sport, this desire to excel, this hatred of the fox. Accursed animal! Should he then defy us? Vile robber! His hour was come! Ah, it is a great feeling, this feeling of sport, my friends, this desire to trample the fox under the hoofs of your horse. I have made the fox chase with the English. I have also, as I may tell you some day, fought the box fight with the Bustler of Bristol. And I say to you that this sport is a wonderful thing, full of interest as well as madness. The farther we went, the faster galloped my horse, and soon there were but 3 men as near the dogs as I was. All thought of fear of discovery had vanished. My brain throbbed. My blood ran hot. Only one thing upon earth seemed worth living for, and that was to overtake this infernal fox. I passed one of the horsemen, a hussar like myself. There were only 2 in front of me now, the one in a black coat, the other the blue artilleryman whom I had seen at the inn. His grey whiskers streamed in the wind, but he rode magnificently. For a mile or more we kept in this order, and then, as we galloped up a steep slope, my lighter weight brought me to the front. I passed them both, and when I reached the crown I was riding level with the little hard-faced English huntsman. In front of us were the dogs, and then, 100 paces beyond them, was a brown wisp of a thing, the fox itself, stretched to the uttermost. The sight of him fired my blood. "Aha, we have you then, assassin!" I cried, and shouted my encouragement to the huntsman. I waved my hand to show him that there was one upon whom he could rely. And now there were only the dogs between me and my prey. These dogs, whose duty it is to point out the game, were now rather a hindrance than a help to us, for it was hard to know how to pass them. The huntsman felt the difficulty as much as I, for he rode behind them and could make no progress toward the fox. He was a swift rider, but wanting in enterprise. For my part, I felt that it would be unworthy of the Hussars of Conflans if I could not overcome such a difficulty as this. Was Etienne Gerard to be stopped by a herd of fox dogs? It was absurd. I gave a shout and spurred my horse. "Hold hard, sir, hold hard!" cried the huntsman. He was uneasy for me, this good old man, but I reassured him by a wave and a smile. The dogs opened in front of me. One or two may have been hurt, but what would you have? The egg must be broken for the omelette. I could hear the huntsman shouting his congratulations behind me. One more effort and the dogs were all behind me. Only the fox was in front. Ah, the joy and pride of that moment! To know that I had beaten the English at their own sport. Here were 300 all thirsting for the life of this animal, and yet it was I who was about to take it. I thought of my comrades of the light cavalry brigade, of my mother, of the Emperor, of France. I had brought honour to each and all. Every instant brought me nearer to the fox. The moment for action had arrived, so I unsheathed my sabre. I waved it in the air, and the brave English all shouted behind me. Only then did I understand how difficult is this fox chase. For one may cut again and again at the creature and never strike him once. He is small and turns quickly from a blow. At every cut I heard those shouts of encouragement from behind me, and they spurred me to yet another effort. And then at last the supreme moment of my triumph arrived. In the very act of turning I caught him fair with such another backhanded cut as that with which I killed the aide-de-camp of the Emperor of Russia. He flew into two pieces, his head one way and his tail another. I looked back and waved the blood-stained sabre in the air. For the moment I was exalted. Superb! Ah, how I should have loved to have waited to have received the congratulations of these generous enemies! There were 50 of them in sight, and not one who was not waving his hand and shouting. They are not really such a phlegmatic race, the English. A gallant deed in war or in sport will always warm their hearts. As to the old huntsman, he was the nearest to me, and I could see with my own eyes how overcome he was by what he had seen. He was like a man paralyzed, his mouth open, his hand, with outspread fingers, raised in the air. For a moment my inclination was to return and to embrace him. But already the call of duty was sounding in my ears, and these English, in spite of all the fraternity which exists among sportsmen, would certainly have made me prisoner. There was no hope for my mission now, and I had done all that I could do. I could see the lines of Massena's camp no very great distance off, for by a lucky chance the chase had taken us in that direction. I turned from the dead fox, saluted with my sabre, and galloped away. But they would not leave me so easily, these gallant huntsmen. I was the fox now, and the chase swept bravely over the plain. It was only at the moment when I started for the camp that they could have known that I was a Frenchman, and now the whole swarm of them were at my heels. We were within gunshot of our pickets before they would halt, and then they stood in knots and would not go away, but shouted and waved their hands at me. No, I will not think that it was in enmity. Rather would I fancy that a glow of admiration filled their breasts, and that their one desire was to embrace the stranger who had carried himself so gallantly and well. End of section 8.
and end of How the Brigadier Slew the Fox. Section 9 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Saved the Army. I have told you, my friends, how we held the English shut up for 6 months, from October 1810 to March 1811, within their lines of Torrevedras. It was during this time that I hunted the fox in their company, and showed them that amidst all their sportsmen there was not one who could outride a hussar of Conflans. When I galloped back into the French lines, with the blood of the creature still moist upon my blade, the outposts, who had seen what I had done, raised a frenzied cry in my honour, whilst these English hunters still yelled behind me, so that I had the applause of both armies. It made the tears rise to my eyes to feel that I had won the admiration of so many brave men. These English are generous foes. That very evening there came a packet under a white flag addressed to the hussar officer who cut down the fox. Within I found the fox itself in two pieces, as I had left it. There was a note also, short but hearty, as the English fashion is, to say that as I had slaughtered the fox, it only remained for me to eat it. They could not know that it was not our French custom to eat foxes, and it showed their desire that he who had won the honours of the chase should also partake of the game. It is not for a Frenchman to be outdone in politeness, and so I returned it to these brave hunters, and begged them to accept it as a side dish for their next déjeuner de la chasse. It is thus that chivalrous opponents make war. I had brought back with me from my ride a clear plan of the English lines, and this I laid before Massena that very evening. I had hoped that it would lead him to attack, but all the marshals were at each other's throats, snapping and growling like so many hungry hounds. Ney hated Massena, and Massena hated Junot, and Soult hated them all. For this reason nothing was done. In the meantime food grew more and more scarce, and our beautiful cavalry was ruined for want of fodder. With the end of winter we had swept the whole country bare, and nothing remained for us to eat, although we sent our forage parties far and wide. It was clear, even to the bravest of us, that the time had come to retreat. I was myself forced to admit it. But retreat was not so easy. Not only were the troops weak and exhausted from want of supplies, but the enemy had been much encouraged by our long inaction. Of Wellington we had no great fear. We had found him to be brave and cautious, but with little enterprise. Besides, in that barren country, his pursuit could not be rapid. But on our flanks and in our rear there had gathered great numbers of Portuguese militia, of armed peasants and of guerrillas. These people had kept a safe distance all the winter, but now that our horses were foundered, they were as thick as flies all around our outposts, and no man's life was worth a sou when once he fell into their hands. I could name a dozen officers of my own acquaintance who were cut off during that time, and the luckiest was he who received a ball from behind a rock through his head or his heart. There were some whose deaths were so terrible that no report of them was ever allowed to reach their relatives. So frequent were these tragedies, and so much did they impress the imagination of the men, that it became very difficult to induce them to leave the camp. There was one especial scoundrel, a guerrilla chief named Manuelo, the Smiler, whose exploits filled our men with horror. He was a large, fat man of jovial aspect, and he lurked with a fierce gang among the mountains which lay upon our left flank. A volume might be written of this fellow's cruelties and brutalities, but he was certainly a man of power, for he organized his brigands in a manner which made it almost impossible for us to get through his country. This he did by imposing a severe discipline upon them, and enforcing it by cruel penalties, a policy by which he made them formidable, but which had some unexpected results, as I will show you in my story. Had he not flogged his own lieutenant? But you will hear of that when the time comes. There were many difficulties in connection with a retreat, but it was very evident that there was no other possible course,
and so Massena began to quickly pass his baggage and his sick from Torre Novas, which was his headquarters, to Combra, the first strong post on his line of communications. He could not do this unperceived, however, and at once the guerrillas came swarming closer and closer upon our flanks. One of our divisions, that of Clausel, with a brigade of Montbrun's cavalry, was far to the south of the Tagus, and it became very necessary to let them know that we were about to retreat, for otherwise they would be left unsupported in the very heart of the enemy's country. I remember wondering how Massena would accomplish this, for simple couriers could not get through, and small parties would be certainly destroyed. In some way an order to fall back must be conveyed to these men, or France would be the weaker by 14,000 men. Little did I think that it was I, Colonel Gerard, who was to have the honour of a deed which might have formed the crowning glory of any other man's life, and which stands high among those exploits which have made my own so famous. At that time I was serving on Massena's staff, and he had two other aides-de-camp, who were also very brave and intelligent officers. The name of one was Cortex, and of the other Duplessis. They were senior to me in age, but junior in every other respect. Cortex was a small, dark man, very quick and eager. He was a fine soldier, but he was ruined by his conceit. To take him at his own valuation, he was the first man in the army. Duplessis was a Gascon, like myself, and he was a very fine fellow, as all Gascon gentlemen are. We took it in turn, day about, to do duty, and it was Cortex who was in attendance upon the morning of which I speak. I saw him at breakfast, but afterward neither he nor his horse was to be seen. All day Massena was in his usual gloom, and he spent much of his time staring with his telescope at the English lines and at the shipping in the Tagus. He said nothing of the mission upon which he had sent our comrade, and it was not for us to ask him any questions. That night, about 12 o'clock, I was standing outside the Marshal's headquarters when he came out and stood motionless for half an hour, his arms folded upon his breast, staring through the darkness toward the east. So rigid and intent was he that you might have believed the muffled figure and the cocked hat to have been the statue of the man. What he was looking for I could not imagine, but at last he gave a bitter curse, and turning on his heel, he went back into the house, banging the door behind him. Next day, the second aide-de-camp, Duplessis, had an interview with Massena in the morning, after which neither he nor his horse was seen again. That night, as I sat in the anteroom, the marshal passed me, and I observed him through the window, standing and staring to the east, exactly as he had done before. For fully half an hour he remained there, a black shadow in the gloom. Then he strode in, the door banged, and I heard his spurs and his scabbard jingling and clanking through the passage. At the best he was a savage old man, but when he was crossed I had almost as soon face the Emperor himself. I heard him that night cursing and stamping above my head, but he did not send for me, and I knew him too well to go unsought. Next morning it was my turn, for I was the only aide-de-camp left. I was his favourite aide-de-camp. His heart went out always to a smart soldier. I declare that I think there were tears in his black eyes when he sent for me that morning. "Gerard," said he, "come here." With a friendly gesture, he took me by the sleeve, and he led me to the open window which faced the east. Beneath us was the infantry camp, and beyond that the lines of the cavalry, with the long rows of picketed horses. We could see the French outposts, and then a stretch of open country intersected by vineyards. A range of hills lay beyond, with one well-marked peak towering above them. Round the base of these hills was a broad belt of forest. A single road ran white and clear, dipping and rising until it passed through a gap in the hills. "This," said Massena, pointing to the mountain, "is the Sierra Muradal. Do you perceive anything upon the top?" I answered that I did not. "Now?" he asked, and he handed me his field glass. With its aid I perceived a small mound or cairn upon the crest. "What you see," said the marshal, "is a pile of logs which was placed there as a beacon. We laid it when the country was in our hands, and now, although we no longer hold it, the beacon remains undisturbed. Gerard, that beacon must be lit tonight. France needs it, the Emperor needs it, the army needs it. Two of your comrades have gone to light it, but neither has made his way to the summit. Today it is your turn, and I pray that you may have better luck." It is not for a soldier to ask the reason for his orders, and so I was about to hurry from the room, but the Marshal laid his hand upon my shoulder and held me. "You shall know all, and so learn how high is the cause for which you risk your life," said he. 50 miles to the south of us, on the other side of the Tagus, is the army of General Clausel. His camp is situated near a peak named the Sierra d'Ossa. On the summit of this peak is a beacon, and by this beacon he has a picket. It is agreed between us that when at midnight he shall see our signal fire, he shall light his own as an answer, and shall then at once fall back upon the main army. If he does not start at once, I must go without him. For 2 days I have endeavoured to send him his message. It must reach him today, or his army will be left behind and destroyed. Ah, my friends, how my heart swelled when I heard how high was the task which fortune had assigned to me. If my life were spared, here was one more splendid new leaf for my laurel crown. If, on the other hand, I died, then it would be a death worthy of such a career. I said nothing, but I cannot doubt that all the noble thoughts that were in me shone in my face, for Massena took my hand and wrung it. "There is the hill, and there the beacon," said he. "There is only this guerrilla and his men between you and it. I cannot detach a large party for the enterprise, and a small one would be seen and destroyed. Therefore, to you alone I commit it. Carry it out in your own way, but at 12 o'clock this night let me see the fire upon the hill." "If it is not there," said I, "then I pray you, Marshal Massena, to see that my effects are sold and the money sent to my mother." So I raised my hand to my busby and turned upon my heel, my heart glowing at the thought of the great exploit which lay before me. I sat in my own chamber for some little time, considering how I had best take the matter in hand. The fact that neither Cortex nor Duplessis, who were very zealous and active officers, had succeeded in reaching the summit of the Sierra de Moradal, showed that the country was very closely watched by the guerrillas. I reckoned out the distance upon a map. There were 10 miles of open country to be crossed before reaching the hills. Then came a belt of forest on the lower slopes of the mountain, which may have been 3 or 4 miles wide, and then there was the actual peak itself, of no very great height, but without any cover to conceal me. Those were the 3 stages of my journey. It seemed to me that once I had reached the shelter of the wood, all would be easy, for I could lie concealed within its shadows and climb upward under the cover of night. From 8 till 12 would give me 4 hours of darkness in which to make the ascent. It was only the first stage, then, which I had seriously to consider. Over that flat country there lay the inviting white road, and I remembered that my comrades had both taken their horses. That was clearly their ruin, for nothing could be easier than for the brigands to keep watch upon the road and to lay an ambush for all who passed along it. It would not be difficult for me to ride across country, and I was well horsed at that time, for I had not only Violette and Rataplan, who were 2 of the finest mounts in the army, but I had the splendid black English hunter which I had taken from Sir Cotton. However, after much thought, I determined to go upon foot, since I should then be in a better state to take advantage of any chances which might offer. As to my dress, I covered my hussar uniform with a long cloak, and I put a grey forage cap upon my head. You may ask me why I did not dress as a peasant, but I answer that a man of honour has no desire to die the death of a spy. It is one thing to be murdered, and it is another to be justly executed by the laws of war. I would not run the risk of such an end. In the late afternoon I stole out of the camp and passed through the line of our pickets. Beneath my cloak I had a field glass and a pocket pistol, as well as my sword. In my pocket were tinder, flint and steel. For 2 or 3 miles I kept under cover of the vineyards and made such good progress that my heart was high within me, and I thought to myself that it only needed a man of some brains to take the matter in hand to bring it easily to success. Of course, Cortex and Duplessis galloping down the high road would be easily seen, but the intelligent Gerard lurking among the vines was quite another person. I dare say I had got as far as 5 miles before I met any check. At that point there is a small wine-house, round which I perceived some carts and a number of people, the first that I had seen. Now that I was well outside the lines, I knew that every person was my enemy, so I crouched lower while I stole along to a point from which I could get a better view of what was going on. I then perceived that these people were peasants who were loading 2 wagons with empty wine casks. I failed to see how they could either help or hinder me, so I continued upon my way. But soon I understood that my task was not so simple as had appeared. As the ground rose, the vineyards ceased, and I came upon a stretch of open country studded with low hills. Crouching in a ditch, I examined them with a glass, and I very soon perceived that there was a watcher upon every one of them, and that these people had a line of pickets and outposts thrown forward exactly like our own. I had heard of the discipline which was practised by this scoundrel whom they called the Smiler, and this was no doubt an example of it. Between the hills there was a cordon of sentries, and though I worked some distance round to the flank, I still found myself faced by the enemy. It was a puzzle what to do.
End of section 9. Section 10 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Saved the Army. Continued. There was so little cover that a rat could hardly cross without being seen. Of course it would be easy enough to slip through at night, as I had done with the English at Torre Vedras, but I was still far from the mountain, and I could not in that case reach it in time to light the midnight beacon. I lay in my ditch, and I made 1,000 plans, each more dangerous than the last. And then, suddenly, I had that flash of light which comes to the brave man who refuses to despair. You remember I have mentioned that 2 wagons were loading up with empty casks at the inn. The heads of the oxen were turned to the east, and it was evident that those wagons were going in the direction which I desired. Could I only conceal myself upon one of them, what better and easier way could I find of passing through the lines of the guerrillas? So simple and so good was the plan that I could not restrain a cry of delight as it crossed my mind, and I hurried away instantly in the direction of the inn. There, from behind some bushes, I had a good look at what was going on upon the road. There were 3 peasants with red Montereau caps loading the barrels, and they had completed 1 wagon and the lower tier of the other. A number of empty barrels still lay outside the wine-house, waiting to be put on. Fortune was my friend. I have always said that she is a woman and cannot resist a dashing young hussar. As I watched, the 3 fellows went into the inn, for the day was hot and they were thirsty after their labour. Quick as a flash, I darted out from my hiding-place, climbed onto the wagon and crept into one of the empty casks. It had a bottom but no top, and it lay upon its side with the open end inward. There I crouched, like a dog in its kennel, my knees drawn up to my chin, for the barrels were not very large, and I am a well-grown man. As I lay there, out came the 3 peasants again, and presently I heard a crash upon the top of me, which told that I had another barrel above me. They piled them upon the cart until I could not imagine how I was ever to get out again. However, it is time to think of crossing the Vistula when you are over the Rhine, and I had no doubt that if chance and my own wits had carried me so far, they would carry me farther. Soon, when the wagon was full, they set forth upon their way, and I within my barrel chuckled at every step, for it was carrying me whither I wished to go. We travelled slowly,
and the peasants walked beside the wagons. This I knew because I heard their voices close to me. They seemed to me to be very merry fellows, for they laughed heartily as they went. What the joke was I could not understand. Though I speak their language fairly well, I could not hear anything comic in the scraps of their conversation which met my ear. I reckoned that at the rate of walking of a team of oxen, we covered about 2 miles an hour. Therefore, when I was sure that 2.5 hours had passed, such hours, my friends, cramped, suffocated, and nearly poisoned with the fumes of the lees, when they had passed, I was sure that the dangerous open country was behind us, and that we were upon the edge of the forest and the mountain. So now I had to turn my mind upon how I was to get out of my barrel. I had thought of several ways, and was balancing one against the other, when the question was decided for me, in a very simple but unexpected manner. The wagon stopped suddenly with a jerk, and I heard a number of gruff voices and excited talk.
"Where, where?" cried one.
"On our cart," said another.
"Who is he?" said a third.
"A French officer. I saw his cap and his boots." They all roared with laughter. I was looking out of the window of the Posada, and I saw him spring into the cask like a toreador, with a Seville bull at his heels.
"Which cask, then?"
"It was this one," said the fellow, and sure enough his fist struck the wood beside my head. What a situation, my friends, for a man of my standing! I blush now, after 40 years, when I think of it. To be trussed like a fowl, and to listen helplessly to the rude laughter of these boors, to know, too, that my mission had come to an ignominious and even ridiculous end. I would have blessed the man who would have sent a bullet through the cask and freed me from my misery. I heard the crashing of the barrels as they hurled them off the wagon, and then a couple of bearded faces and the muzzles of 2 guns looked in at me. They seized me by the sleeves of my coat, and they dragged me out into the daylight. A strange figure I must have looked as I stood blinking and gaping in the blinding sunlight. My body was bent like a cripple's, for I could not straighten my stiff joints, and half my coat was as red as an English soldier's from the lees in which I had lain. They laughed and laughed, these dogs, and as I tried to express by my bearing and gestures the contempt in which I held them, their laughter grew all the louder. But even in these hard circumstances, I bore myself like the man I am, and as I cast my eye slowly round, I did not find that any of the laughers were very ready to face it. That one glance round was enough to tell me exactly how I was situated. I had been betrayed by these peasants into the hands of an outpost of guerrillas. There were 8 of them, savage-looking, hairy creatures, with cotton handkerchiefs under their sombreros and many buttoned jackets with coloured sashes round the waist. Each had a gun and 1 or 2 pistols stuck in his girdle. The leader, a great bearded ruffian, held his gun against my ear while the others searched my pockets, taking from me my overcoat, my pistol, my glass, my sword, and worst of all, my flint and steel and tinder. Come what might, I was ruined, for I had no longer the means of lighting the beacon, even if I should reach it. 8 of them, my friends, with 3 peasants, and I unarmed. Was Etienne Gerard in despair? Did he lose his wits? Ah, you know me too well. But they did not know me yet, these dogs of brigands. Never have I made so supreme and astounding an effort as at this very instant when all seemed lost. Yet you might guess many times before you would hit upon the device by which I escaped. Listen, and I will tell you. They had dragged me from the wagon when they searched me, and I stood, still twisted and warped, in the midst of them. But the stiffness was wearing off, and already my mind was very actively looking out for some method of breaking away. It was a narrow pass in which the brigands had their outpost. It was bounded on the one hand by a steep mountain side. On the other, the ground fell away in a very long slope, which ended in a bushy valley many hundreds of feet below. These fellows, you understand, were hardy mountaineers, who could travel either uphill or down very much quicker than I. They wore abarcas, or shoes of skin, tied on like sandals, which gave them a foothold everywhere. A less resolute man would have despaired, but in an instant I saw and used the strange chance which fortune had placed in my way. On the very edge of the slope was one of the wine barrels. I moved slowly toward it, and then, with a tiger spring, I dived into it feet foremost, and with a roll of my body I tipped it over the side of the hill. Shall I ever forget that dreadful journey? How I bounded and crashed and whizzed down that terrible slope! I had dug in my knees and elbows, bunching my body into a compact bundle so as to steady it, but my head projected from the end, and it was a marvel that I did not dash out my brains. There were long, smooth slopes, and then came steeper scarps, where the barrel ceased to roll and sprang into the air like a goat, coming down with a rattle and crash which jarred every bone in my body. How the wind whistled in my ears, and my head turned and turned until I was sick and giddy and nearly senseless. Then, with a swish and a great rasping and crackling of branches, I reached the bushes which I had seen so far below me. Through them I broke my way, down a slope beyond, and deep into another patch of underwood, where, striking a sapling, my barrel flew to pieces. From amid a heap of staves and hoops I crawled out, my body aching in every inch of it, but my heart singing loudly with joy, and my spirit high within me, for I knew how great was the feat which I had accomplished, and I already seemed to see the beacon blazing on the hill. A horrible nausea had seized me from the tossing which I had undergone, and I felt as I did upon the ocean when first I experienced those movements of which the English have taken so perfidious an advantage. I had to sit for a few moments with my head upon my hands beside the ruins of my barrel, but there was no time for rest. Already I heard shouts above me which told that my pursuers were descending the hill. I dashed into the thickest part of the underwood, and I ran and ran until I was utterly exhausted. Then I lay panting and listened with all my ears, but no sound came to them. I had shaken off my enemies. When I had recovered my breath, I travelled swiftly on and waded knee-deep through several brooks, for it came into my head that they might follow me with dogs. On gaining a clear place and looking round me, I found to my delight that in spite of my adventures I had not been much out of my way. Above me towered the peak of Merodal, with its bare and bold summit shooting out of the groves of dwarf oaks which shrouded its flanks. These groves were the continuation of the cover under which I found myself, and it seemed to me that I had nothing to fear now until I reached the other side of the forest. At the same time I knew that every man's hand was against me, that I was unarmed, and that there were many people about me. I saw no one, but several times I heard shrill whistles, and once the sound of a gun in the distance. It was hard work pushing one's way through the bushes, and so I was glad when I came to the larger trees and found a path which led between them. Of course, I was too wise to walk upon it, but I kept near it and followed its course. I had gone some distance, and had, as I imagined, nearly reached the limit of the wood, when a strange moaning sound fell upon my ears. At first I thought it was the cry of some animal, but then there came words, of which I only caught the French exclamation, "Mon Dieu!" With great caution I advanced in the direction from which the sound proceeded, and this is what I saw. On a couch of dried leaves there was stretched a man dressed in the same grey uniform which I wore myself. He was evidently horribly wounded, for he held a cloth to his breast which was crimson with his blood. A pool had formed all round his couch, and he lay in a haze of flies whose buzzing and droning would certainly have called my attention if his groans had not come to my ear. I lay for a moment, fearing some trap, and then, my pity and loyalty rising above all other feelings, I ran forward and knelt by his side. He turned a haggard face upon me, and it was Duplessis, the man who had gone before me. It needed but one glance at his sunken cheeks and glazing eyes to tell me that he was dying. "Gerard," said he, "Gerard." I could but look my sympathy, but he, though the life was ebbing swiftly out of him, still kept his duty before him, like the gallant gentleman he was. "The beacon, Gerard," "You will light it?"
"Have you flint and steel?"
"It is here."
"Then I will light it tonight."
"I die happy to hear you say so." "They shot me, Gerard, but you will tell the Marshal that I did my best."
"And Cortex?"
"He was less fortunate. He fell into their hands, died horribly. If you see that you cannot get away, Gerard, put a bullet into your own heart. Don't die as Cortex did."
I could see that his breath was failing, and I bent low to catch his words. "Can you tell me anything which can help me in my task?" I asked.
"Yes, yes, de Pombal, he will help you. Trust de Pombal."
With the words, his head fell back, and he was dead.
"Trust de Pombal. It is good advice."
To my amazement, a man was standing at the very side of me. So absorbed had I been in my comrade's words, and intent on his advice, that he had crept up without my observing him. Now I sprang to my feet and faced him. He was a tall, dark fellow, black-haired, black-eyed, black-bearded, with a long, sad face. In his hand he had a wine bottle, and over his shoulder was slung one of the trabucos, or blunderbusses, which these fellows bear. He made no effort to unsling it, and I understood that this was the man to whom my dead friend had commended me.
"Alas, he is gone," said he, bending over Duplessis. "He fled into the wood after he was shot, but I was fortunate enough to find where he had fallen, and to make his last hours more easy. This couch was my making, and I had bought this wine to slake his thirst."
"Sir," said I, "in the name of France, I thank you. I am but a colonel of light cavalry, but I am Etienne Gerard, and the name stands for something in the French army. May I ask?"
"Yes, sir. I am Aloysius de Pombal, younger brother of the famous nobleman of that name. At present, I am the first lieutenant in the band of the guerrilla chief who is usually known as Manuelo, the Smiler."
My word, I clapped my hand to the place where my pistol should have been, but the man only smiled at the gesture.
"I am his first lieutenant, but I am also his deadly enemy," said he. He slipped off his jacket and pulled up his shirt as he spoke. "Look at this," he cried, and he turned upon me a back which was all scored and lacerated with red and purple weals. "This is what the Smiler has done to me, a man with the noblest blood of Portugal in my veins. What I will do to the Smiler you have still to see."
There was such fury in his eyes and in the grin of his white teeth that I could no longer doubt his truth, with that clotted and oozing back to corroborate his words.
"I have 10 men sworn to stand by me," said he. "In a few days I hope to join your army when I have done my work here. In the meanwhile..."
A strange change came over his face, and he suddenly slung his musket to the front.
"Hold up your hands, you French hound," he yelled. "Up with them, or I blow your head off."
You start, my friends, you stare. Think then how I stared and started at this sudden ending of our talk. There was the black muzzle, and there the dark, angry eyes behind it. What could I do? I was helpless. I raised my hands in the air. At the same moment, voices sounding from all parts of the wood. There were crying and calling and rushing of many feet. A swarm of dreadful figures broke through the green bushes. A dozen hands seized me, and I, poor, luckless, frenzied I, was a prisoner once more. Thank God there was no pistol which I could have plucked from my belt and snapped at my own head. Had I been armed at that moment, I should not be sitting here in this cafe and telling you these old-world tales. With grimy, hairy hands clutching me on every side, I was led along the pathway through the wood, the villain de Pombal giving directions to my captors. 4 of the brigands carried up the dead body of Duplessis. The shadows of evening were already falling when we cleared the forest and came out upon the mountainside. Up this I was driven until we reached the headquarters of the guerrillas, which lay in a cleft close to the summit of the mountain. There was the beacon which had cost me so much, a square stack of wood, immediately above our heads. Below were two or three huts which had belonged, no doubt, to goat-herds, and which were now used to shelter these rascals. Into one of these I was cast, bound and helpless, and the dead body of my poor comrade was laid beside me.
End of section 10.